4. A Protestant Christmas. The Christmas tree was a pine twig stuck in a crack in the top of a stool. A multicoloured string of low-wattage bulbs was wound around it twice. Milk-white, vinyl-covered wires connected them to an accumulator on the floor. The stool stood in a corner of the room, in the passage between two double bunks. The mattress from one of the upper bunks screened the whole corner and the tiny Christmas tree from the glare of the overhead lights. 6 men in thick, dark blue denims, of the sort worn by parachutists, had taken their stand by the tree and were listening gravely, heads bowed, as one of their number, brisk Max Adam, said a Protestant Christmas prayer. There was no one else in the whole large room, which was densely furnished with identical double bunks, welded together by the frames. After supper and an hour to stretch their legs, all the others had gone to work the evening shift. Max finished his prayer, and all 6 sat down. 5 of them were overwhelmed by bittersweet nostalgia for their homeland, their beloved, orderly and reliable Germany, under whose tiled roofs this first festival of the year was so joyous and so moving. The 6th, a big man with a bushy black beard, was a Jew and a communist. Fate had intertwined Lev Rubin's fortunes with those of Germany, in peace and war. In peacetime he had been an expert on the German language. He spoke impeccable modern Hochdeutsch, but could, when necessary, have recourse to several dialects. Every German who had ever put his name to a published work he remembered as effortlessly as if he had been a personal acquaintance. He spoke of little towns on the Rhine, as though he had often strolled about their well-washed, shady streets. In fact, he had been only in Prussia, and only with the army. As a major in the Department of Psychological Warfare, he had singled out in prisoner of war camps Germans reluctant to remain behind barbed wire and willing to assist him. He carried them off and housed them comfortably in a special school. Some of them would be passed back through the lines, equipped with TNT and forged Reichsmarks, leave passes, and army paybooks. They might blow up bridges, or they might just roll on home and enjoy themselves until they were caught. With others he talked about Goethe and Schiller, and discussed the broadcasts they would make through megaphones, urging their brothers in arms to turn their weapons against Hitler. Some of his collaborators, with a flair for ideology, found it particularly easy to switch from Nazism to communism, and they were transferred in due course to various Free German Committees, where they prepared themselves for the socialist Germany of the future. The simple soldiers among them, and Rubin himself with them, by the end of the war had twice crossed the ruptured front lines and taken fortified positions by force of persuasion, so as to save Soviet manpower. But in his efforts to convert Germans, he had inevitably begun to feel close to them, gotten to like them, and, once Germany was prostrate, to pity them. That was what had landed Rubin in prison. His enemies in the administration accused him of speaking out against the slogan, "Blood for blood, a death for a death," after the offensive of January 1945. It was more or less true. Rubin did not try to refute it. It was infinitely more complicated than it might appear from a newspaper report or the wording of the charge against him. By the stool with the illuminated Christmas tree, 2 lockers had been pushed together to serve as a table. They began serving one another. There was canned fish. Prisoners in the Sharashka were allowed to make purchases from Moscow shops. There was lukewarm coffee, and there was homemade cake. The conversation was sober and subdued. Max steered it onto peaceful subjects, old folk customs, sentimental Christmas Eve stories. Alfred, the bespectacled Viennese physics student, whose course had been interrupted by the war, spoke with a comical Austrian accent. Gustav, a moon-faced youngster with a piglet's pink transparent ears, stared wide-eyed at the Christmas lights, scarcely daring to join in the conversation of his elders. A member of the Hitler Jugend, he had become a prisoner of war 1 week after the war ended. The conversation, however, took a wrong turn. Somebody mentioned Christmas 1944, 5 years back, and the Ardennes offensive. The Germans, to a man, were proud of this glorious piece of ancient history. The vanquished had routed the victors. And they remembered how, on that Christmas Eve, Germany had listened to Goebbels. Rubin, one hand toying with a strand of his bristly black beard, confirmed what they said. He remembered that speech. It had been a great success. Goebbels had spoken as though it cost him a great mental effort, as though he bore on his own shoulders all the burdens that were bringing Germany to its knees. He probably had already a presentiment of his own end. SS-Obersturmbannführer Simmel, whose long body could scarcely fit in between the table and the double bunk, did not appreciate Rubin's politeness. He couldn't bear the idea that this Jew would dare to express any opinion of Goebbels at all. He would never have demeaned himself by sitting at the same table with Rubin if he had felt able to forego Christmas Eve with his compatriots. But the other Germans were all insistent that Rubin should be there. For this little group of German exiles, storm-blown into the gilded cage of a Sharashka in the heart of barbarous and chaotic Muscovy, there was only one person with whom they felt any kinship, only one they understood. This major in the enemy's army, who had spent the whole war sowing the seeds of discord and moral collapse among them. Only he could make comprehensible the customs and mentality of the natives, advise on behavior, and translate the latest international news from Russian. Casting around for a remark that would really sting Rubin, Simmel said that anyway, there were hundreds of pyrotechnic orators in Germany. Why, he wondered, was it the rule with the Bolsheviks to read out speeches submitted for approval beforehand? The taunt was all the more hurtful for being justified. There was no point in trying to explain to an enemy and a murderer that oratory, wonderful oratory, had once existed in Russia, but that party committees had stamped it out. Rubin felt only disgust for Simmel, nothing more. He remembered Simmel's arrival in the Sharashka after years in Butyrki prison, wearing a creaking leather tunic. There were still marks on the sleeve where the insignia of the SS, the civilian SS, the worst of the lot, had been picked off. Even prison had not softened the expression of hardened cruelty on Simmel's face. Simmel was the reason why Rubin had not wanted to come to tonight's supper party. But the others had begged him so earnestly, and he felt so sorry for them, lost and lonely as they were, that he could not cast a cloud on their celebration by refusing. Rubin suppressed his urge to explode, and translated into German Pushkin's advice not to judge a shoe by its uppers. Max mildly interrupted what might have developed into a quarrel with his own version of a dubiously relevant line from Pushkin. Under Lev's guidance, he said, he could now spell out poems by Pushkin in the original. But why hadn't Reinhold taken any whipped cream with his cake? Where, though, had Lev been that Christmas Eve? Lev recalled that he had been in his dugout near Rozhan, in the Nareyev bridgehead. And just as the five Germans recalled their torn and trampled Germany, piously painting it in the brightest colours, Rubin, too, found vivid memories returning of the Nareyev bridgehead, then of the sodden forests along the Ilmien. The Christmas tree lights were reflected in moist eyes. As usual, they asked Rubin for the latest news. But he would have felt awkward offering a review of the past month. He could not let himself become a neutral purveyor of information, could not give up hope of re-educating these people. Yet he could not convince them that in our complicated age, socialist truth sometimes forces its way forward by a tortuous path. All he could do was select for them, as he did for history, and without realizing it, for himself. Only those current events that confirmed that the high road had been accurately predicted, ignoring those that seemed likely to divert it into a quagmire. But December had been a month in which, apart from the Sino-Soviet negotiations and the boss's 70th birthday, nothing positive seemed to have happened. He would feel ashamed, and it would serve no educational purpose to tell the Germans about Trychokostov's trial, at which the foreign correspondents had been confronted rather late in the day with a sham recantation, allegedly written by Kostov in his death cell, so that the whole crude judicial farce had come apart at the seams. On this occasion, Rubin dwelled mostly on the historic victory of the Chinese communists. The amiable Max listened to Rubin and nodded encouragement. His eyes were guileless. He was attached to Rubin, but since the Berlin blockade, had begun to distrust much of what he said, and, unknown to Rubin, in the shortwave lab where he worked, he had occasionally risked his neck by assembling, listening to, and then dismantling, a miniature receiver that looked nothing at all like a receiver. He had heard, from Cologne and on the German service of the BBC, Not only how Kostov had retracted the self-incriminating statements that his interrogators had obtained by torture, but also about the consolidation of the Atlantic Alliance and the new prosperity of West Germany. He had, of course, passed all this on to the other Germans, and they lived for the day when Adenauer would free them. Still, they nodded politely as Rubin talked. Anyway, it was high time for him to be gone. He had not been released from the evening shift. He praised the cake. Hildemuth, the fitter, bowed in gratification, and asked the company to excuse him. His hosts politely delayed his departure. Then they thanked him for coming, and he thanked them for having him. After which the Germans settled down to sing Christmas carols, sotto voce. Just as he was, with a Mongolian Finnish dictionary and a slim volume of Hemingway in English under his arm, Rubin went out into the hallway. The hallway was broad, with an unpainted and scuffed wooden floor. There were no windows, and the electric light was on day and night. It was the same hallway in which, during the supper break an hour earlier, other lovers of novelty had interviewed the new Zeks, fresh from the camps. Of the doors along the hallway, one opened onto the inner prison stairway, and several others belonged to room cells. They were rooms, because the doors had no locks, but they were also cells, because spy holes, little glass windows, had been set in the doors. The guards here had no use for these peepholes, but they had been adopted in accordance with the regulations for real prisons, simply because the name given to the Sharashka in official documents was Ministry of State, Special Prison No. 1. Through one such peephole could be seen a Christmas Eve party like the one he had left for the Latvian fraternity, who had also been given time off. All the other Zeks were at work, and Rubin was worried that he might be stopped at the exit and dragged off to the security officer to give an explanation in writing. At both ends of the hallway there were doors that filled its whole width. At one end a wooden four-panelled folding door under a semicircular arch led to what had once been the sanctuary of the seminary's church, and was now also a room cell. At the other there was a locked two-panelled door, reinforced from top to bottom with sheet iron. This door, which led to their place of work, the prisoners called the Royal Gates. Rubin walked up to the iron door and knocked on the Judas window, a guard's face pressed against the glass on the other side. The key turned quietly in the lock. As luck would have it, the guard was easygoing. Rubin went out onto the grand stairway of the ancient structure, crossed the marble landing, walked past two ornate wrought iron lamps, which no longer gave light. Still on the second story, he entered a hallway and pushed open a door marked Acoustics Laboratory.